Welcome, everyone. It is wonderful to see you for this happy, happy occasion. I think this is a celebration on three levels. One is the most important level, but I'll mention the other two first. So the first is it's a celebration of the field of legal history as a field, which is really thriving and burgeoning. And we have a wonderful array of distinguished scholars and friends here to join us. The second is a celebration of legal history at UVA, which is a long-standing strength, both in the law school and among our friends in the history department. And we have recently been adding to that strength with a number of folks here in the audience and some who couldn't be with us, and also especially for today, Cynthia Nicoletti. And that is the most important thing we're celebrating today, Cynthia Nicoletti and her magnificent book. I first met Cynthia at the Hearst Institute in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. The Hearst Institute is where young legal historians who are very, very promising go to meet each other and do some work on their projects. And she was still a graduate student then, and so she was already clearly a rising star to be at the Hearst Institute. And then when she finished the dissertation that she was working on at that time, I was lucky enough to be on the William Nelson Cromwell Prize Committee for the American Society for Legal History, which she won. And everyone on the committee was blown away. I was blown away, as was everyone else, by the story she was telling, her conceptualization of the story, the reach of her story, the research, the theoretical reach. It was just brilliant, and it was still a dissertation. It is hard to overestimate, and maybe Liz Varon will tell us more about this, it is hard to overestimate how many books have been written about the Civil War and how hard it is to say new things about the Civil War. And maybe Liz will contradict me in a minute, but I think Cynthia has really said new things. Oh, look, she's nodding. Cynthia has really said new things about the Civil War and about really fundamental aspects of the Civil War by bringing together her real chops as a Civil War historian, a 19th century American historian, and her incisive understanding of the law. I was delighted when we brought her to UVA. I was unsurprised when she won the 2015 William Nelson Cromwell Foundation Research Fellowship, another mark of a rising star. And I watched her over the next several years edit and rework her dissertation into this wonderful book under the guidance of her editor, Sally Gordon, who unfortunately can't be with us here today, but who was supposed to. And she honed the story, she honed the narrative, she filled out her character, she nailed down every legal detail, she expanded on the conceptual and theoretical insights, and I was so proud, but not at all surprised, when she won the Cromwell Book Award as well. And let me just be clear, these awards all have the same name because the Cromwell Foundation has been very generous to the American Society for Legal History, but they are all separate. They all have different committees. They are given in different years. And so every time, Cynthia has just beat out all of the competition. So all of these committees over almost a decade have come to the same conclusion that this is just the best legal history work around. I'm so proud of Cynthia and the work she does. I thank George for organizing today and being such a guiding force, and I very much look forward to hearing what everyone has to say. Thank you all for being here.
So thank you, Risa. I'd also like to thank Ginny Clayton for arranging this event. There will be a reception after our discussion and questions and answers from among you in the audience. Just as we're celebrating Cynthia as a prize-winning author, we have a distinguished panel of historians who are also prize-winning authors who are here. Sorry, Sally Gordon couldn't make it. I infer that she has succumbed to the ills of February, which have struck many of us as this month goes on. Let me just briefly introduce the panelists here. Laura Edwards is the Peabody Family Professor of History at Duke University. She's written several books on women, gender, and the law in the 19th century. Most recently, she has written A Legal History of the Civil War and Reconstruction, A Nation of Rights. Seems to me to be a very ambitious book. I look forward to reading it. Michael Ross is professor of history at the University of Maryland. His most recent book is the great New Orleans kidnapping case, race, law, and justice in the Reconstruction era, issues that still resonate in our country to this day. And Elizabeth Varon comes to us from our own Department of History, where she is the Langhorne Williams Professor of American History, and she is Associate Director of the Now Center for Civil War History. Her most recent book is Appomattox, Victory, Defeat, and Freedom at the End of the Civil War. As you can see, all of these panelists are superbly qualified to comment on Cynthia's book, and I look forward to what they have to say. They will speak briefly, and then Cynthia will respond, and we'll open up the discussion for questions, both from the panelists and from you. For my part, I have no substantive comments beyond this one. In the immediate background to the treason prosecution of Jefferson Davis are the prize cases. Decided during the Civil War on the issue whether the Union Navy could take Confederate vessels as prizes and have them forfeited in a federal court of admiralty. This demonstrates to me, as a teacher of admiralty, the centrality of this field to our structure of government and the foundations of the Constitution. I hope our panelists and Professor Nicoletti concur in this judgment, but I expect that they will not discuss it at length. So, Laura, please.
Okay, so is this, can you hear me?
Excellent.
Well, thank you first for the invitation, and George, thank you for organizing this, and it's lovely to be here, and it's really lovely to get a chance to comment on Cynthia's book and to talk about it. So Cynthia's book here, Secession on Trial, focuses on this central but largely unexplored question of secession's legality. Now, I have to fess up here. I thought this topic was kind of curious when I first heard about it. So I'm, you know, Cynthia's telling me, or I've heard about, I forget the exact context, but I'm hearing about this topic and I'm thinking, didn't that get resolved by the end of the Civil War? I mean, didn't that all, you know, Union victory kind of put this thing to rest? So I remember trying to look polite. Oh, that topic. Okay. But then after I heard Cynthia talk about it more, I realized really how wrong I was. It's not the topic that's curious. It's actually this whole scholarly silence surrounding the topic that's curious. So while secession dominates historical debates about the events leading up to the Civil War, it completely drops out of the scholarship once the war ends. And its disappearance, as Cynthia explains, is actually part of the reason why I also thought secession was resolved. The assumption is that I and other historians assume that the war's outcome settled this whole question of secession, that victory of the United States over the Confederacy put an end to the possibility of secession, end of story, right? But that's actually not right at all. And as Cynthia shows, the Civil War did not settle the legality of secession at all. And in fact, Americans continued to struggle with the legality of secession after the war, and for good reason. Not only was there really no clear legal answer to this question, but secession's legality also had profound, really far-reaching implications for the politics of Reconstruction as well. So the legal arguments that Republicans during Reconstruction used to explain their use of federal power was based on the fundamental legal contradiction when it came to secession. They explicitly upheld the inviolability of the United States while implicitly supporting the legality of secession and thereby undercutting the national governing form that they were seeking to preserve. So they're doing one thing and the other thing and they're like, oh, well, we'll just not talk about that. And as Cynthia shows, the best, most widely used arguments against secession actually lay in concepts that really don't have any firm grounding in the governing structure of the 19th century United States, namely this notion of trial by battle, what I was assuming as well without knowing that I was assuming it. And the trial by battle is that the war litigated, so to speak, right, the issue of secession, and then the victory of the United States served as the jury's verdict on all of that. so to speak. And so we had this trial by war, and now we're done with this. But that's not really a legally framed argument here. This is really more of an empty metaphor, right? It's this metaphor of trial by battle. You put it out there, and then you don't have to say anything else, right? And in fact, trial by battle then doesn't really explain changes in the law. And as a result, Cynthia argues, the legality of secession, this central question in 19th century U.S. history, was really never resolved. And even court cases like Texas v. White, which pronounced the Union indestructible after the war, did not put the issue to rest. And as George actually notes in a really great review of Cynthia's book, the reasoning is based on this problematic link between the Articles of Confederation and the U.S. Constitution, which casts the Constitution as kind of the revision of the Articles. They were perfecting a union that already was. But in fact, that's not really the case. And the Union of States then actually has this very tumultuous history, which a lot of the law during this period is covering up. So the Union has been made and remade and made and remade many times, although not always in as dramatic terms as the Civil War. But nonetheless, this is a Union that is not as indestructible and as firmly tied together as what the sources would suggest. So more to the point here, and I think here's the incredible contribution of Cynthia's book. The legality of secession was actually impossible to resolve within the existing legal framework of the nation. Now, you have to kind of stop and let this sit in. It's like, oh, we can't actually deal with this question. Law can't really resolve this particularly well. And Cynthia then follows Americans' attempts to grapple with secession's legality through Jefferson Davis's treason trial, which was inseparable from this issue. So Davis could only be guilty of treason if the Confederacy had not left the United States, which of course then placed the Republicans who supported the prosecution of Confederate officials in this really awkward position, that contradiction. They're arguing for the legality of secession, but that actually jeopardized Reconstruction policies that many of them also supported, policies that hinged on the assumption that secession was in fact illegal. So here, the book takes on this extremely difficult task. It's constructing a narrative around a trial that never happened. So trial by battle, it's a metaphor. The actual trial of Jefferson Davis, it never happened. Now, having come to know Cynthia better, I think that this particular approach is something that only she would attempt. It sort of is an intellectual challenge that requires a wry sense of humor about the whole process to even embark on it, I think. And so Cynthia is then focusing on the lawyers involved in the trial, their social, cultural, political worlds, and the strategies they pursued. So she's talking about the whole context of this trial that never happened, and she's constructing this brilliant narrative around this non-event, which is really a difficult task. So all of that, narrating this trial, requires that Cynthia take a very broad view of the law, one not centered wholly in law books or in courtrooms. And this view of the law is consistent with one of the book's main points, that the law played a particularly important role in American society in the 19th century. So now we're moving from secession and Jefferson Davis to actually a larger sort of commentary about the role of law in the 19th century. And as she's showing, law resided in close proximity to Americans' lives. It framed the way people understood a range of social and political issues, their identities as Americans, their responsibilities, and their expectations of government. Now, all of these people had a particularly close relationship to law and also felt comfortable weighing in on it, what it was, what it was supposed to be doing. And they had an expectation, too, that their opinions mattered. So they have a very specific relationship to law, one that we need to understand in this context of this particular century. And here, actually, Cynthia's work is contributing to a growing body of work in legal history that is breaking down barriers in other fields of social history, of cultural history, political history, and then uniting that with legal history by highlighting and exploring the centrality of law in 19th century American culture more generally. So law, as Cynthia argues, was not separate from other aspects of life, and thus is also inseparable from them. It's deeply implicated in all of these other areas that many historians have imagined to be separate. So this book does something really important here historiographically. It mainstreams legal history. It expands our understanding of legal history while also making legal history central to fields in American history that often ignore the law or just don't really engage in it critically. And I think this is because of that separation. Law is over here, it's not part of everyday life. And Cynthia's really showing us something quite different. So then, as Cynthia is arguing, the strategies of lawyers and public discussions of the trial were as crucial in working through the legal issues surrounding secession and ultimately the bonds that held the United States together. And all those debates outside the formal arena of law were as important as the decisions and policies of the nation's lawmakers. So the dynamics of this trial didn't happen, it's about secession's legality and all the attendant implications, all of those dynamics of that that were happening outside the courtroom are forcing this onto the national agenda. And in so doing, Jefferson Davis's trial reveals fault lines in the fundamental premises on which the nation's governing institutions were based. So all this debate out there, all this discussion, moves these questions of secession into the national agenda, which in fact lawmakers are not that excited about, and yet then it forces them to confront this. And then it exposes this fundamental contradiction. They expected the nation's laws to resolve this, but the nation's laws weren't really very capable of handling this particular issue. So here's the problem. In this instance, this legal order failed. The very thing that people expected to resolve the problem couldn't resolve the problem. And here, I come back to what I think is so brilliant about this book. As Cynthia argues, the legality of secession was really impossible to resolve within the existing legal framework of the nation. With this insight, then, Cynthia challenges our presumptions about the place and power of law in the United States as well. Most scholars of U.S. history, be they legal historians or not, look to the legal system as the place where problems could be resolved. And this is particularly true in the historiography of the Civil War era. Historians have tended to blame the outbreak, for instance, of hostilities on the failure of the political system or the legal system or both. Somehow that system failed, but it was, you know, a fault there. In this one instance it failed, but otherwise that system would have been able to resolve this. And similarly, historians have blamed the failure of Reconstruction on the limits of its policy, the interpretation of the policy, and the enforcement of the policy. But Cynthia is taking issue with those historiographical characterizations, emphasizing the limits of law and the legal system. And so she's saying that perhaps the law and the legal system never could have resolved those problems in the first place. It's not just a failure, but something more systemic that's going on here, especially in resolving these larger questions about the nation's union, the union of states, and what's actually at the basis of the United States here. So after reading Cynthia's book, I am struck by how much the scholarship in both law and history today actually still reflects that faith that 19th century Americans had in the law as the locus of authority and the means of resolving a wide range of conflicts in our lives, large and small, today and in the past. And that faith, I'm realizing more and more, says more about American culture in the 19th century and our inheritance from the 19th century as it does about the law's actual capabilities. We have this faith in the law, but there are moments and times when the law and the legal system may well fail us. And in the instance of secession, law really did fail. And by implications, we scholars of law then have much to learn from Cynthia's book. We should view the law and the legal system more critically as a crucial element of the history that requires explanation, not as a place that's outside that history, which could provide the answers if only used appropriately, if we didn't mess it up somehow. And as Cynthia's book also suggests, the fragility of the United States may not be a problem, it may actually be central to the legal order, in the sense that change is inevitable, but in the sense that that fragility is also built into the fundamental legal structure as well. So Cynthia's book made me think very broadly about all these questions, and I thank you for that, Cynthia, and I'm looking forward to discussion.
So I regularly have my students debate, was secession legal? And then they're always like, didn't the Supreme Court decide that? And if anyone has read the Supreme Court's decision in Texas versus White, which supposedly decided the issue, it's a deeply unsatisfying and complicated decision. And one of the things that Cynthia has turned up is a mountain of evidence that at the time, people said that the question of secession was decided on the battlefield, and references to the medieval practice of trial by battle. And I was stunned by how many people used that as their reference point, because I don't think today that would be the case in a similar instance. And I'm going to drill down on that a little, because I think it's one of the most innovative parts of Cynthia's book. And students in my constitutional history course are always bemused when in my lecture on the origins of trial by jury, we discuss trials by ordeal. How could anyone, they wonder, have believed that forcing accused persons to stick their arms in boiling water or grasp red-hot plowshares were legitimate means of determining guilt or innocence? Though my students are slightly more familiar with trial by battle, thanks perhaps only to the trial of Tyrion Lannister in episode 38 of Game of Thrones, they remain perplexed how anyone believed trial by battle was just. The best I can do is explain that in the Middle Ages, people lived in a world of signs and wonders and believed God regularly revealed his will through illnesses, fires, droughts, and other portents and punishments. Clergy, moreover, participated in the ordeals and gave sanction to the belief that God would directly intervene in the outcome. But when in 1215, Pope Innocent III banned clergy from participating in the ordeals, the one relatively coherent justification for ordeals disappeared. And as a result, in England, juries eventually replaced trial by water, trial by hot iron, and other tests satired centuries later by Monty Python. And yet, as Professor Nicoletti notes, one ancient form of dispute resolution, trial by battle, lived on and remained a technically valid form of proof in England until 1819, even though Blackstone disparaged the practice as emanating, quote, from a superstitious frame of mind, it being an appeal to providence that heaven would give victory to him who had the right. Each time I read Nicoletti's Secession on Trial, which I've read many times, I was also on the prize committee that the Cromwell Prize Committee, and I'm also an Oliver Cromwell reenactor. That's a joke. I find it striking how many Civil War era editors, politicians, jurists, and public commentators were conversant with the ancient practice of trial by battle. That would not be the case today. I Googled the number of modern conflicts, and no references to trial by battle appear in commentary. Nicoletti explains that in the antebellum period, Americans, particularly in the South, were in the midst of a cultural revival of medieval romanticism, spurred in part by Sir Walter Scott's popular novel, Ivanhoe, which featured a trial by battle. And in the South, appeals to chivalry and affairs of honor were not dead. Nevertheless, the numerous references Nicoletti has found by Civil War era leaders, jurists, and commentators to trial by battle are eye-opening. But as they made their arguments over whether or not the Union Army's victory had settled the question of secession's constitutionality, one key component of medieval trial by battle is repeatedly missing in their analysis: the supernatural component, the role of God. Instead, many commentators seem to use trial by battle as a euphemism for might makes right, rather than a means of revealing God's will. As Nicoletti notes, proponents argued trial by battle was a form of direct democracy through which people made law outside of the formal legal processes. Critics decried as barbarism using war to decide constitutional questions. Maybe I overlooked someone, but I couldn't find anyone in Professor Nicoletti's book who argued trial by battle had settled the secession question and that God had delivered that outcome. And that was in part, I think, what made many in the North uneasy about the Davis trial. Removing God's will from trial by battle left only might makes right. An unsettling conclusion for Americans who prided themselves on honoring the rule of law. Nicoletti writes that if the verdict in the Davis trial had not matched the results of the war, Americans might have been forced to acknowledge that war was ultimately more powerful than law. But would Americans have had the same unease if it was widely held that the war's outcome proved God had vanquished secession rather than the North's overwhelming numbers and resources? When I read Professor Nicoletti's book, I always feel the ghost of Abraham Lincoln hovering over the proceedings, because by the war's end, Lincoln clearly viewed the war as a trial by battle, but one in which slavery had dwarfed secession as an issue, and in Lincoln's formulation, God did directly determine the scale and outcome of the contest. Whereas Lincoln's first inaugural address in 1861 was a long meditation on the legitimacy of secession, his second inaugural, 4 years and over 700,000 lives later, barely alludes to it. I recognize that many, if not all, the people in this room are probably familiar with Lincoln's second inaugural, but I'm going to quote from it here for illustrative effect. In that address, Lincoln, sniffling like I am, argued that when the war began, no one thought slavery would be destroyed as a result of the conflict. Each side, quote, looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both sides, Lincoln continued, read the same Bible and prayed to the same God, and each invoked God's aid against the other. But, he said, the prayers of both could not be answered, and neither had been fully answered. Lincoln then suggested that with the war, God was punishing the North and the South for allowing slavery to continue beyond its appointed time. And he added these famous and haunting lines, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war may pass speedily away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Here, in Lincoln's version of trial by battle, God certainly intervened in the conflict, dictating its scale and outcome. And although Lincoln believed God was punishing both North and South, he surely also, with the war winding down in March 1865, believed God would award victory to the side that was now fighting to end slavery, the Union. Professor Nicoletti wrestles with this point in a long footnote in her Trial by Battle chapter. She notes that trial by battle had deep resonance as a religious idea, and she mentions Lincoln's second inaugural as evidence that some saw God's hand in the war, a group that also included many Southern theologians. But one question I have for Cynthia is, why does there seem to be two tiers in the trial by battle idea? It's almost as if that if trial by battle was about slavery, God intervened, but if it was just about the constitutionally a secession, he had other things to do. And, you know, why is that? This also brings me back to the Davis trial. And Davis's lawyer, Charles O'Connor, kind of an evil genius, whose threat to use the trial to vindicate secession helped spur the hand-wringing in the Johnson administration and the press. In her introduction, Nicoletti admits a grudging admiration for O'Connor's legal acumen. "I both admire and fear him," she writes, and rightly so. In addition to saving Davis from trial, O'Connor skillfully helped nudge the public debate over the war's meaning away from the moral question of slavery towards the less consequential legal issue of secession. O'Connor's strategy worked hand in glove with lost cause propagandists like Edward Pollard, who had already begun writing histories claiming secession and states' rights were the issue over which the Civil War was fought, not slavery. Or as James McPherson has called it, the Immaculate Secession. I find myself admiring Thaddeus Stevens. I don't know if you folks knew this, but Thaddeus Stevens, the great abolitionist, volunteers to defend Davis in his trial, a twist that I only learned from reading Nicoletti's book. For Stevens, secession's constitutionality was morally insignificant compared to the need to tear out slavery root and branch in the South. If acquitting Davis and vindicating secession could aid that process, he was all for it. If the war had been between two belligerent nations after a valid secession, the North could now treat the former Southern states as conquered provinces and, under the doctrine of conquest, reorganize those societies at will. Land redistribution and other revolutionary policies could proceed unimpeded by constitutional niceties. As Nicoletti recounts, Davis later said he declined Stephen's offer, not from any lack of confidence in his ability, but because Davis was aware what would be his line of argument. To quote Davis, it would have been that the seceding states were conquered provinces and were to all intents and purposes a foreign power which had been overthrown. That would have been an excellent argument for me, but not for my people. Instead, O'Connor blustered, Johnson waffled, Davis's trial never occurred, and as Nicoletti expertly recounts, many Americans accepted that secession's constitutionality had been settled by the Supreme Court's complicated and unsatisfying decision in Texas versus White, and by a version of trial by battle that substituted might makes right for God's will, and as a result, the unease lingers. And quickly, Cynthia, I'd love to some question about why there's two levels of trial by battle, but also there's another abolitionist who's defending Davis, Jarrett Smith, if you could tell me what he's up to, and I'd love just to hear you talk about what you think of Salmon P. Chase. I think he's your...
okay.
Okay. Thank you.
There are so many things to praise and admire about Professor Nicoletti's book, and I'd like to hone in on her argument about the stakes of the Davis treason case. She carefully parses for us what made the case, as she puts it, too risky to try and too politically volatile to drop. I'll briefly summarize her argument, and then I'll suggest that the stakes were even higher than she lets on, the political stakes. And I'll do this to underscore the broad significance of her book, the important contribution she's made in breaking the scholarly silence on Davis's case, as Professor Edwards put it. So why was the Davis case the subject of so much heated debate and political angst? Nicoletti deftly explains that the dominant unionist interpretation of the legal character of the war, the dual theory, that the Confederacy was both a sovereign belligerent and a criminal insurgency, was at stake. The dual theory had been advanced by Lincoln and Seward and formalized in the prize cases, but a big question remained: could that dual theory provide a legal framework for holding rebels to account? Federalism, too, was at stake. Americans faced the unsettling prospect that the changes the war wrought might spiral out of control, leading to the unchecked aggrandizement and centralization of the federal government and completely undermining the autonomy of the states. Finally, Nicoletti tells us, the very rule of law was at stake. Americans worried, in the wake of the war, that a might makes right mentality could erode legal norms. Now, as persuasive as Professor Nicoletti is in establishing that Davis's fate mattered to late 19th century Americans, more remains to be said about why it mattered. And building on her account, I'd like to suggest that three political theories that had been absolutely foundational to the Union war effort were at stake in the Davis trial. First, the slave power conspiracy theory. Second, the effective theory of the Union. And finally, the idea of American exceptionalism itself. Interestingly, Davis's detractors and his defenders alike in the North jockeyed to position themselves as the champions of these ideas, and the power of these ideas helps account for why, in the end, both sides could claim victory. That is to say, Davis escaped punishment, but Chase established the illegality of secession. So first, let's consider the slave power conspiracy idea. Can everyone hear me, by the way? Good. All right. This was the slave power conspiracy idea, the Republican Party's central article of faith. It posited that a small cabal of slaveholding oligarchs, in league with some truckling Northern Democratic politicians, held the non-slaveholding white Southern masses in their thrall, depriving them of education and free speech, economic prosperity, and democratic representation. According to this ubiquitous Northern political trope, the white Southern masses were deluded dupes, themselves victims of slaveholder tyranny at the hands of men like Jefferson Davis. The purpose of the Union war was to break the spell of the secessionist elite, the spell they'd cast, a spell Northerners often likened to Satan's sway over his minions. The impulse to blame secession on the slaveholding elite and to imagine that the white Southern masses could be redeemed remained strong among Unionists from the start of the war to the finish. It was at work in Lincoln's offer of amnesty to repentant Southerners in his December 1863 10% plan. It was at work, too, in Grant's lenient peace terms at Appomattox and in Johnson's policy of amnesty and pardon. The slave power conspiracy idea theory is conspicuous in post-war debates over Jefferson Davis's fate. In the eyes of his critics, Davis was not only the arch traitor, but also the arch slaveholder and the arch hardliner among Confederates, goading the Confederate populace to fight to the last ditch. So to try Davis was to test the idea that the Southern masses could be disenthralled from their elite overlords. High stakes. That is why Judge Underwood's 1866 charge to the grand jury in Virginia in the Davis case vowed that the government sought to, quote, punish the principals and not the tools, and why Underwood characterized the Southern masses as dupes steeped in an ignorance he traced to slavery and imposed upon by Davis to join the rebellion. That is why Davis's critics so often rhetorically indicted him for victimizing his own people, a common Northern charge. Northerners accused Davis of tyrannizing Southern whites with policies such as conscription, seducing and bullying them into fighting a war that consigned them to poverty, desolation, and death, as one Northern newspaper put it. But revealingly, those who opposed holding Davis to account didn't reject the deluded masses theory, they appropriated it to their own ends. And I'll say a few words about Gerrit Smith, to whom we'll return. Gerrit Smith, one of those arguing mercy and conciliation, explained in May of 1867 that the Southern masses, lacking, as he put it, the intelligence and individuality of the Northern masses, were closely bound to their leaders, and thus, if the leaders were resentful of the North and discontented with its policies, the masses would be too, and reconciliation would remain elusive. So, Gerrit Smith reasoned, Davis had to be forgiven so that he in turn could induce the Southern masses to forgive the North and to reunite with Northerners. Closely linked to the slave power conspiracy theory was the effective theory of union. The notion that the Union was designed by the Founding Fathers to be consensual, a political entity bound together not by force, but by tender emotions such as affection and love. Americans associated the effective theory of union with the Revolutionary Forefathers and with antebellum nationalists such as Andrew Jackson and Daniel Webster, who in times of crisis had appealed to the strong emotional bonds between Americans. As the scholar Michael Lee Woods has perceptively noted, the effective theory appeared on both sides of the slavery controversy and on both sides of the secession debates. Unionists argued that they could reverse sectional alienation and rekindle the affection of the South. Secessionists argued that conflict over slavery had irrevocably broken those bonds of affection. The effective theory worked together with the slave power conspiracy theory to sustain Northern hopes of reconciliation with the South. The idea was that by punishing the Southern elite, again, of whom Davis was the ultimate symbol, but forgiving the masses, Northerners could maintain the ideal of a consensual union held together by heartstrings. The effective theory of union, too, was conspicuous in the treason trial debates. Many of those Northerners, intent on punishing Jefferson Davis, felt that he was supremely guilty not only of betraying their trust, but of spurning their affection. As an article in the National Intelligencer put it in May of 1865, Davis, who had played such a prominent role as a U.S. Senator and Secretary of War in the Pierce administration, had been, quote, honored and petted by the North far beyond his peers, and he should therefore have known better than to vilify Northerners, better than to join ranks with the secessionists. Davis knew, the paper said, that the sections were not enemies. He knew that the large soul of the North loved the South and was proud of the South and was willing to forgive its fiery temper. Northern newspapers, in other words, repeatedly described Davis as the pet and favorite who sat on velvet in Washington while contemplating parricide, as one paper put it. Those who sought his punishment saw Davis as the most hate-filled of all Confederates and utterly unrepentant, the personification not only of the crime of secession, but of the unbroken spirit of secession. And they weren't wrong to see him in this way. He had been the ultimate hardliner. No one did more than Davis, the Bangor, Whig, and Courier editorialized in June of 1867 to, quote, fire the Southern heart and inflame the worst passions of the Southern people against the citizens of the North. Again, a true statement. But the effective theory of the Union was itself politically promiscuous. It could be and was used both by those who advocated mercy and conciliation towards the rebel leader as well as by those who advocated punishment. Davis's defenders, and again we'll use Gerrit Smith as an example, Davis's defenders emphasized that both sides must forswear bitterness and retribution. Smith, who believed that the North and South shared culpability for slavery in the war, insisted that a shared spirit of atonement would restore what he called the heart union. As he put it, the magnet of our repentance will quickly draw after it the South's own repentance. He imagined the sections united in a sisterly embrace. The effective theory of the Union was, in turn, tied to the doctrine of American exceptionalism. In the minds of loyalists, bonds of affection among its citizens were part of what made the Union great and indeed exceptional in the world, a shining beacon of representative government and prosperity and progress. And as Nicoletti notes, the theme of American exceptionalism is prominently on view in the Davis case. Those who believed Davis guilty of treason condemned the Confederate president for rejecting the peaceful mode of revolution that was built right into the very framework of the American government. Instead of seeking lawful, constitutional, or electoral change, Davis had sought to overthrow this government by force, and that made him, according to Joshua Speed, whom Nicoletti quotes, more guilty than traitors in any other part of the world. Again and again in press coverage of the Davis case, we see Northerners make the argument that there were no valid grounds for rebelling against a democratic republic. And we see Northerners arraign Davis as the ungrateful wretch who sought to crush the most beneficent government in the world, to quote the abolitionist Wendell Phillips. Phillips represented those Northerners who thought that if the government failed to hold Davis to account, it would jeopardize the Union's singular standing in the eyes of the world as a republic of laws. But American exceptionalism, too, could and did cut both ways. In the eyes of those who urged mercy and conciliation, Horace Greeley, for example, it was America's civil end to its civil war, its mercy and a magnanimity in victory on the part of the Union more than anything else that proved that America was distinct and singular superior, not destined to experience the interminable miseries of the old world. My aim here is to underscore the emotional stakes of the Davis case. If I have any criticism of this magnificent book, it would simply be that at times there's an overemphasis on Davis as a symbol and losing sight of him as a man. So Nicoletti quotes the New York Herald saying that the question of secession's legality was of such monumental importance that it made the disposition of Davis's personal fate pale in comparison. And to be sure, that question of secession's legality was of monumental importance, and we've signaled it some of the ways. But I'd emphasize that the political was personal here. Many Northerners believed that Davis, Jefferson Davis, in word and deed, personified the slave power conspiracy and the ruthless ambition of the master class. And those Northerners who felt that way were intensely invested in Davis's guilt and deeply disappointed when the case against him fell apart. Nicoletti's so brilliant in showing how a strategy of sort of masterly delay is practiced by lawyers on both sides. And we should note that the Republican press frequently decried this strategy of masterly delay, called it out, and felt profoundly dispirited by it and ashamed of it. As a Boston minister put it in June of 1867 when Davis was set free on bail, quote, ghosts seemed to rise from 100 battlefields and skeletons came from the grave of Andersonville and Libby to reproach the nation that forgets the sacrifices of its departed heroes. high emotional stakes. Attention to these stakes can help illuminate, in turn, Chase's logic in Texas v. White. Chase drew in that decision on the effective theory of union, as Nicoletti suggests when she identifies Lincoln's first inaugural address as Chase's inspiration. But Chase also drew on the slave power conspiracy theory and on its wartime corollary, the idea that the Union War was a war to deliver the mass of Southerners from the tyranny of secession, to save them from themselves. Chase writes in Texas v. White that if Texas had ceased upon secession to be a state and had become foreign, then the, quote, the war must have ceased to be a war for the suppression of the rebellion and must have been a war for conquest and subjugation. It was unthinkable to Chase to stipulate, to concede, to imagine that the war had been a war of conquest. That would have meant capitulating to Jefferson Davis's ideology and view of the world, abandoning the Union's bedrock view that slaveholder dominance had deprived the Southern masses of truly Republican governments. Nicoletti characterizes Chase's pronouncement on secession in Texas v. White as perfunctory, and in terms of its legal reasoning, she's right and persuasive. But in a political sense, that pithy ruling is the tip of an iceberg, and below the waterline lies a strong foundation of deeply ingrained beliefs and hard-fought principles. Thanks.
Thank you all for those amazing comments. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to cover all of them. So hopefully if I don't, when I sit down, we can have a discussion about some of them. I also want to thank George Rutherglen for putting this together. It was really amazing, and all the work that went into it by you and Jenny, I really appreciate, and I'm so glad that everybody was able to come and to give me these amazing comments. One part of me wishes that I'd had them, or I wish I had another draft almost, right, after these comments, because they're so amazing, and just think of the book I could have written had I had them all beforehand. So I'll just take some of them that I jotted down while everyone was talking. Laura talked about the way in which I really conceive of law as central to 19th century Americans' understanding of the world, and how I really think about this as part and parcel of how Americans conceived of themselves. We are a law-abiding people, and how the Civil War really complicates how we understand that very thing. And I have to say that this is indeed the very reason I became a legal historian of the Civil War, and probably why I'm surprised that not every legal historian studies the Civil War, because I find this so fascinating, right? This is why I keep coming back to this, right, is that I find this fascinating, because I feel like if you're interested in how Americans conceive of themselves, why not put it under stress, like the ultimate stress of, you know, the war, and the challenge that it mounts in terms of how Americans think about law. And I think in some ways I think maybe my fundamental conception of myself as a historian, I'm pushing back against the idea that this is a period in which law is sort of gone. And it's not totally gone, right? And I really want to talk about, you know, how people are really conflicted about the role that law would play in something that's so violent and really mounts such a fundamental challenge to the rule of law and indeed how Americans conceive of themselves, right? So I think that probably this is something that Americans think about, but maybe it's in the back of our minds in ordinary times, but you actually see people wrestling with it, you know, in their diary day to day, if you study the Civil War. And so this is one of the reasons that I'm drawn to it, maybe the primary reason. Anyway, so that really is, I think, probably you're right to identify it as at the heart of the book, because it is something that's near and dear to my heart. Let's see. I think, Laura, you mentioned this, but Mike also brought it up. But in terms of thinking about maybe why I really focused on secession as the central issue that, you know, that my book is about, and really reviving it in terms of, you know, the legal history of the Civil War, you know. So I think Laura's impulse, why would you write about that? I think many people shared that impulse, probably including my advisor at some point. But I really did think about that as an underexplored issue. I'm thinking right now about my second book, and lest I bit off more than I could chew for the first one, I'm interested in this question of how is it that the end of slavery gets resolved too? And so that I really want to take that on in my second book, and to think about, you know, to what extent Mike is right to point out that I have one long footnote on sort of the religious dimensions of trial by battle. I think I also have maybe a shorter footnote on, it's interesting to think about how people might have conceived of the end of slavery in terms of trial by battle. Did they think that, you know, it's the constitutional amendments that resolve all of this? To what extent are they thinking about the battlefield as settling that central issue? And so I picked up that footnote, and now I'm going to write a whole book. I think you're right to point out that I do have sort of two levels of thinking about this, right? And the trial by battle stuff, I didn't really wrestle so much with the religious dimension of it, because I don't know that they're grounding it in the same type of moral dimension that they might be for slavery. And I think I sort of put that aside mentally, but I'm hoping that I can pick it up and maybe do some more wrestling with that concept as I work on my second project. I do agree with the two levels. I think I saw some glimmers maybe of people talking about God's will, but not Southerners. They don't want to go there, right? They certainly, you know, they don't want to suggest that, you know, that not only did they lose because of, you know, stronger armies, but also because, you know, God was behind those armies. I see a little bit of thinking about it among Northerners, but it's not really pronounced. That's what I would say about, you know, what I saw in general. Also about Jarrett Smith and what was he doing. I do think that, Liz picks up on him too, right? And so I talk about Jarrett Smith and also Horace Greeley, two abolitionists who support Davis in the post-war period and really are looking to free him. Horace Greeley both of them put up money for his bail and some other prominent Northerners. And that was something that I think surprised me as I was writing the book, is how much how deep these connections ran, and I think that Jarrett Smith was pretty sincere in thinking that, you know, that reconciliation was really important, and that Davis certainly represented a way of reconciling both North and South. He also, I'll mention, is pretty good friends with some of Davis's lawyers, so he's also writing letters back and forth to at least one of them. So he's pretty involved in the whole process, and I think is a central character here. Even more central, this brings me to Salmon P. Chase. Chief Justice of the United States, who writes the Texas versus White decision and flees the Davis case on many, many occasions whenever he can. I'll admit, cheese is not my favorite. I would say I wrote every draft of this book really disliking Chase, and maybe some of it for reasons that are a little unfair. I mean, I don't think in terms of him as a person, but unfair to this book. So I read a lot of Chase's letters. He has bad handwriting. I probably held that against him. I was reading bad handwriting on microfilm. A lot of people, I think, point to Chase as, so he's not just an abolitionist, but he's also a feminist. He was a big champion of his older daughter. When I read his letters, I felt a lot for his younger daughter because he kept pointing out, why can't you be more like Kate? And so I felt bad. That didn't make it into the book. But I will say that there was that backdrop. But I also felt that Chase was my one character who sort of never admitted that this was hard, right? That this issue of trying to figure out, you know, how do we settle the legality of secession in the aftermath of this war, and to think about the connections between war and law is really something that was difficult to do. And he always acts, with one little exception, as though the battlefield has nothing to do with this, and this is sort of a strict legal calculus, although it cannot be the case that that's true based on what he did. I think I was sort of ruthless in thinking about him until the very last draft of my book, which was sort of a terrible feeling. I had reread it the last time, and the last time I reread it, I felt bad for him. I thought, well, what would I do? I'd probably do just what he did, you know, that I felt all sort of this crushing pressure that he has. Then I thought, oh, I'm too hard on him. It was the last draft, so I think I maybe put a little bit more pro-Chase than I had felt throughout. Those were my feelings about Chase. You'll tell me if I'm wrong or not. Liz's comments about Davis as a symbol and thinking about, you know, these stakes attached to Davis as a person. So first, I will admit that I think you're 100% right that he's a symbol in this book. Anybody who would read this book and think, I really want to know what Jefferson Davis was doing on a day-to-day basis, there's not that much of it in this book. I really did think of the central characters as the lawyers, for sure. I certainly read, I read a lot about Davis, he frankly didn't interest me that much, probably, because I felt like... So I admitted how I felt about Chase. I felt about Davis that he whined a lot. I know that that sounds bad. I mean, he was in chains and whatever, but I did think, you know, he was somebody who caused this war, and his wife is really central in putting together his legal team and, you know, telling him, let's have realistic expectations, and she is really maneuvering along with his lawyers, and he is pretty unrealistic, and, you know, he says, he wants to be a martyr, and he says, I want to die for my country, and he's got, you know, four small children under the age of 10, and they have no means of support, and so I probably felt less sympathetic to him than I did to his wife, for sure. But he does end up being a symbol in this book, and I also think what you're talking about in terms of thinking about him as a person and the stakes, the emotional stakes that go along with that. If I'm going to point to things in my own book that I think are not there and could be there and maybe would make for good topics for graduate students looking for history topics, I think one could write something about the Davis trial where they think about it in terms of the lost cause narrative really separating out the way that the Davis trial gets spoken about when it's a live issue, when secession's a live issue, and then how it gets rethought, you know, later 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. And I think that actually it's really two distinct conceptions now that I started thinking about it. So For instance, if you ever read internet boards about Davis's trial, which you shouldn't, but there's this narrative that suggests there's this interesting sort of fake quotation from Salmon P. Chase, where according to this fake quotation, he says we can't put Jefferson Davis on trial because that will expose the faulty nature of the union's theory of permanency. He never said that. I remember I traced that, and it appears for the first time in about 1920 from one of the Lost Cause magazines. But now it gets told as though it happened in 1867 or something like that. And the quotation that's close to it is something that Davis's lawyer said, actually, right? So how this narrative gets constructed today among lost causers about how people were afraid to put Davis on trial, I think is something that they start thinking about, right? They're the seeds of it in, 1865, 1867. But it takes on a life of its own, and that would be, that would be great as my third book or something like that, or graduate student topic. But thank you so much for all of these comments. They're amazing. And thank you so much for coming.